AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Thousands of children flee violence and poverty in their Central American homelands, making their way across the U.S. border with Mexico with the knowledge they will be in this country for years without the worry of being sent back. An AP investigation has found two reasons for the huge influx. One is the overburdened and flawed immigration court system. The other, a 2002 law intended to protect children's rights. The Border Patrol has apprehended more than 52,000 children crossing the border illegally since last fall. Most spend about a month in custody before they are reunited with their parents or other relatives who are in the U.S. There is no requirement that those relatives were legally allowed into the country. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Cairo in an effort to ease a strain on the U.S. relationship with Egypt's new president.
There are issues of concern, as the minister mentions, but we know how to work at these, and I look forward to having that discussion with him this morning.
The Obama administration is concerned about the Egyptian government's crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. Egypt, for its part, is frustrated by the U.S. reluctance to release hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid. Kerry next heads to Jordan to start a series of meetings on the crisis in Iraq. Another town in western Iraq has fallen to Sunni militants in what appears to be a major offensive to secure the area that the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant wants to carve out of Iraq and Syria. The Syrian civil war has spilled over into Israel. A civilian vehicle in the Golan Heights area targeted by forces in Syria. A 15-year-old Israeli boy is dead. The AP's Joe Fetterman has more.
There have been a few cases where things were fired across the border. Sometimes it's accidental spillover. Sometimes they say it's intentional. This is the first time anybody's been killed.
The Israeli military says tanks returned fire, hitting Syrian government position. This is AP Radio News. One of David Letterman's writers is avoiding making a decision about what to do once the show is over. Warren Levinson with more.
We all know David Letterman is leaving the CBS Late Show next year, but what about the people who help make Letterman Letterman? Bill Sheft, who's been writing jokes for Dave since 1991, says when it comes to his pending job crisis, denial helps.
When they say, what are you going to do? I say, look, I got another 180 shows left, and I'm not really thinking about that. This is me living the non-psychological life.
Sheft's new novel, Shrink Thyself, is a comic romp about a man who turns his back on psychotherapy. He's also at work on a sequel to The Ringer, possibly the best softball novel ever written. Warren Levinson, New York.
Video gamers are in Southern California to battle aliens and bad guys for cash and glory. The Orange County Register reports more than 1,000 esports players taking part in the Major League Gaming Championships in Anaheim. They're playing for $150,000 in prize money. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Hi, I'm Ravina. I'm 7 years old and I'm blind. You can help me live the life I want.
Help Ravina and other blind people by making a tax-deductible donation of your used car, truck, or almost anything with wheels to the National Federation of the Blind. Just call 855-659-9314 or visit carshelpingtheblind.org. That's carshelpingtheblind.org. And if you know a blind person who needs help, email nfb@nfb.org.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
June is Men's Health Month. For men over age 60, abdominal aortic aneurysm, also called AAA, is the third leading cause of sudden death. Major risk factors for AAA in men include family history, smoking, and high blood pressure. It is recommended that men between the ages of 65 and 75 who have ever smoked get a one-time ultrasound screening. Men with a family history of AAA should be screened by age 60. With early detection, the condition is treatable. For more information, visit radiologyinfo.org. That's radiologyinfo.org.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Colin Callahan, with my co-host, Mark Cohen of Opti4. We have a great lineup of guests for you today, starting with Kevin Lancaster, who is the CEO of Windvale. And then we have Ronnie Mervis, owner of Mervis Diamond Importers. Then Farhan Hamid, who is the CEO of Enadev Corporation. And then Cedric Nash, president and CEO of Oakland Consulting Group. But first up, it's my pleasure to introduce you to Kevin Lancaster, who is the CEO of Windvale. Kevin, welcome, and what is Windvale?
Thanks for having me. Windvale is a government contracts consulting firm and a hybrid organization where we also provide technology solutions to government agencies, public sector, so federal, state, and local agencies. Mm-hmm. So the benefit, why I say hybrid, is that we're able to take our best practices in selling technologies and implementing technologies, bring those best practices to our commercial clients that also want to sell into the public sector. Mm-hmm. So we give them this practice what we preach kind of service to help them really excel mm-hmm. in the marketplace.
And did you found this company?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did.
And what drove you? What was the driver, the special thing that said, I'm going to do this myself?
Well, I've always been very entrepreneurial minded, mm-hmm. Dating back to my early childhood days on through college. I went to University of Maryland, and although I got a history degree, I actually had the pleasure of working at the Dingman Center for Entrepreneurship as an undergrad intern. And so I got to see all types of businesses and business plans come through the doors and present their case, and some succeeded, some didn't, but that's the nature of entrepreneurship.
Yeah. And so, how young were you when you realized you had an attraction to it, or something you wanted to drive towards was entrepreneurship?
Pretty young. I do have vivid memories of maybe being 8, 9, 10 years old, and seeing my brother, who was 10 years my senior, building a very successful real estate practice. Mm-hmm. And so I saw him hustling out there and really making it happen.
So and you were 8 and he was 18 and he was already selling real estate.
Yeah, right. Wow. About there. Maybe 10 and maybe he was 20, but somewhere in that range.
Casting
a big shadow, but also laying a great foundation. Uh-huh. I mean, I literally got to see all aspects from a sales perspective, mm-hmm. of how to navigate that process. But the great thing about watching my brothers, you see the passion of what he was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, a house wasn't just a house. A house was, you know, a place that people were going to, you know, live and, you know, build families. And so he wasn't selling that dream. He embodied that. And that's what I think, that's why he was so successful in that space, is that he really got his mind around what his prospects were looking to do. Mm-hmm. And help them do it. And so I saw that and I said, I want to do something like that when I get older.
You mentioned in the green room about needing to stay ahead of everyone. Where did that come from?
You know, I don't know, quite frankly. It's just something it's a drive, I guess. It may be that more matriculated as the early days of Windvale, when we were fighting the whole SEO battle. That's probably the best way to kind of describe this. You don't really think of the name Windvale. It's not synonymous with a government contract or, mm-hmm. you know, federal this, public sector that. And so we always had to fight this SEO battle, the early days of Google's domination on SEO. Mm-hmm. And so I always, you know, I just locked myself in my room, my office, at times, and figure out how the heck do we get in front of everybody else? How do we leapfrog and you know, first position and all that stuff? And so, One of the earliest ways we conquered that was we went out and bought GSAschedule.com and governmentcontract.com and said, well, if we can't beat them at the SEO game, we'll buy the SEO game and buy these, you know, cars.com type websites that drive the marketplace. So
so you got in early on that.
You know, and they're great domains still to this day. They do drive a lot of business, but it's not just, you know, from an SEO or a
yeah. There's a, I'm hearing a strategy piece that early on strategy was something that intrigued you.
Yeah, you know, we it's a great foundation. The business had a phenomenal foundation and rooted in developing GSA schedules, which are, you know, a small. Segment or, you know, GSA schedules represent probably 10%, give or take, of all government procurement. So we always looked at it. We served a very niche marketplace, but how can we expand ourselves? How can we add more value to our clients? And so that's where I think the strategy came into play. How can we be different and provide more value as opposed to here's just your contract vehicle and best of luck.
Yeah.
And call us when you need us. And so we got to the point probably 4 or 5 years into our evolution where we got our own contract vehicles. We started selling to the government. We started reselling technologies, implementing technologies. Mm-hmm. And so we took a step back several years ago and realized, you know, there's the strategy.
Yeah.
You know, let's let our clients benefit from our lessons learned.
So I get a sense that as you had mentioned, your brother was a big influence to you. Mm-hmm. And you told us a story that was a big turning point that happened to you when you first recall, hey, he really is an impactful guy.
Yeah, it's a great story. I remember one evening, I was probably in high school or middle school, I can't remember, but he gave me a call. I was sitting at home in our living room watching The Wheel of Fortune. I definitely remember that. He said, hey, do me a favor. I'm driving by the house real quick. I don't have a pen. I need to write something down. Can you come outside real quick and bring me a pen? I thought that's an odd request. It's fine, yeah, whatever. You know, so he pulls up, and I walk up to the car, and he turns the inside of the light on in the car, and then there's Pat Sajak sitting in the back seat. And I'm thinking to myself, this is very odd.
Surreal, yeah.
I was just inside watching the TV, and you are Pat Sajak sitting in my brother's back seat, you know. And so when you're, you know, in your teens, early teens, you know, that's pretty damn impressive.
Pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, and so he ended up, I guess, selling him a house in Severna Park, Maryland. And that's when I realized my brother was kind of a rock star. So
A lot of times, you know, we hear stories of guys who are trying to catch up to their brother. But I get a real sense that your brother was a mentor to you.
Oh, yeah.
And that he kind of took you under his wing and guided you along the way.
Yeah, he absolutely did. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, my formative years, I owe a debt of gratitude to him because he did take me under his wing. He, you know, not just from a business perspective, but he really took care of both me and my sister. You know, and so, yeah, it wasn't a brotherly competition. It was more of, I think what I've done in my career is more maybe an homage to his success.
What were your mom and dad doing when you were growing up?
So my father retired out of NSA, and of course I don't really know what he did over there. He'll never tell me. He'll take that to his grave. But so he comes out of a government background, linguistics, I guess. And my mother sold real estate, you know. So I think she kind of laid the foundation for my brother the real estate realm, if you will.
So I'm thinking you learned from your brother, but that couldn't be the only thing that drove you to become an entrepreneur. Was there anything else involved as you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely. There was certainly a benefit of having some fantastic, you know, childhood friends. And one of the greatest things about that with both Michael and Mark, their parents owned their own small businesses as well. One owned a printing shop. Another one owned a jewelry store, and as kids, we would go to their, you know, stores, and we would see their fathers, you know, at work and working hard and building very successful businesses. And remember as a in my teens going to Mark's father's jewelry store up in Brooklyn Park, Maryland. Mm-hmm. It's since closed, but I got at the holidays help sell jewelry. Mm-hmm. You know, but as I was doing that, and I was going to Mr. Mastromarino's printing shop, I was very aware, very cognizant, you know, looking around and observing of how, you know,
right. So
how cool it was.
You were learning wherever you could.
I tried. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So do you have children of your own now?
I do. Mm-hmm. I have two fantastic children, uh-huh. Nicholas, who's 7, and Cameron, she is 5. Uh-huh. And a phenomenal wife as well.
Uh-huh. Is it tougher to be a business owner or a father?
Depends on what day of the week it is. Depends if I'm rushing out of D.C. to go coach my 7-year-old's hockey team at the Naval Academy, uh-huh. or going to coach machine pitch baseball. But they're both equally challenging, and I can't say they're both equally rewarding. I mm-hmm. can certainly say having kids is much more rewarding.
Yeah.
But they've been... Yeah, they're amazing, yeah, little mini-me's, I guess.
Yeah. Is your brother aware of your success today?
He is, uh-huh, yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
If he were here today, what would he tell us?
I think he'd pat me on the back, and he would say he's proud. Dude. I mean, he absolutely, you know, he's fantastic like that, fantastic support, yeah. So, yeah.
Great. Kevin, what's the website?
Our website is winvale.com. It's WINVALE.com.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offutt Kerman. What is Offutt Kerman, Doug?
Offutt Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tysons Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener, and I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into too particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease, and the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying. And we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying. And since then, he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Right. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offuttkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offutt Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Colin Callahan, and my co-host, Mark Cohen. It's now my pleasure to introduce you to Ronnie Mervis, who is the owner of Mervis Diamond Importers. So welcome,
correct. Thank you.
Welcome, Ronnie. And tell us, what is Mervis Diamond Importers?
Well, like the three words in the name say, mm-hmm. Mervis Diamond Importers. Mervis is my family name, mm-hmm. and my name, of course.
Yep.
Diamonds are our business, and importing is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
We import beautiful diamonds from the source, South Africa, and other countries in Southern Africa, Botswana and Namibia,
mm-hmm.
into the United States, and we distribute them both to other dealers and to the public at large And we have a lot of fun and pleasure in doing that.
Mm-hmm. And what was the impetus to come to Washington to do the distribution part?
We were living in South Africa, mm-hmm. Decided to come across to the United States and internationalize our business. Mm-hmm. The obvious first choice would have been New York, but we didn't want to go to New York. Mm-hmm. New York is a big, bustling city, and we thought we can get all the advantages of Washington mm-hmm. and more without mm-hmm. having to be in New York. So Washington was really our second choice, but it became our first choice, and we were very happy to come here, mm-hmm. which was a hospitable city, not nearly as competitive as New York, which gave us a great chance to get going, mm-hmm. and we took it, and we've done very well with it. Thank you.
And, of course, it was part of the family business, the
mining. Diamonds had been in our family business, in South Africa mm-hmm. since the early 30s, mm-hmm. and as kids, we knew it growing up. And so it was an easy transition for us.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any memories as a kid when you sort of first realized the diamond business was going on? And it was in your family.
It was in the family. When we were kids, my mm-hmm. father used to bring rough diamonds home uh-huh. For his work purposes, and we used to dive into them and play with them. And
right.
we learned as kids how to grade them and how to estimate the color and the clarity and mm-hmm. the cut. And so I can't say they were toys, and I don't want to give the impression that we were rich kids who did nothing but play with diamonds.
Right.
Because these were really diamonds which were being prepared for cutting and polishing.
Right.
And my father would bring them home as part of his homework. Mm-hmm. But we played with them. Mm-hmm. And so we just acquired a love and an interest for diamonds at a very early age.
Right. So it was really, although they weren't toys, there was a game aspect of you learning.
There was a game
business.
Aspect where yeah. they'd be on the table, and there'd be a little tin, and they'd come right. rolling out. And
which would, yeah.
fool around with him. Uh-huh. And so we learned to play and touch them at a very early age.
Right. And he was, in a way, he was training you by playing the games of cut and clarity.
Well, he was training us, but he also taught us business concepts and uh-huh. thoughts and ethics and decision making, in a sense. So there was a big learning experience mm-hmm. in it.
And you said you had three brothers.
There are three brothers. I'm one of the three. There's uh-huh. an older brother. Uh-huh. He is still in South Africa. He runs the family business in Johannesburg today. Mm-hmm. And I have a younger brother who's with me in Washington, mm-hmm. and we run our operation in the United States.
You started it here. So you're the middle child.
I'm the middle pip.
So your brother was tapped to run the family business, and you said, I want to go into the diamond business.
I don't think I said that when I was there.
Right.
I did a lot of things in South Africa.
Tell us about that.
I formed a watch company. We imported a well-known brand of Swiss watch. Uh-huh. I was also in law practice for a while. Until I reached the age of 40, and we decided we wanted to make a change in our lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And we came to the United States, where my brother, one of the brothers, and I mm-hmm. set up our diamond business. And it was only then, really, that I got involved in the diamond business, as mm-hmm. opposed to being versed in it
right.
as an atmosphere in which we grew up.
Well, what was most surprising when you came to Washington to start this business? What was most surprising to you about that?
Well, what really surprised us was it was pretty easy to get going, uh-huh. and we would supply our diamonds to other stores. We were importers and wholesalers, mm-hmm. so we went around and we would sell our diamonds to the chain stores and to various others, and we expected them to have a really quick sell-through, mm-hmm. but they didn't. Mm-hmm. We were appalled at the fact that the sell-through was very slow, and the diamonds would get blocked up in the pipeline, and nothing really happened, and we realized that why it was happening was because most of the people we were selling to were greedy mm. and they put on much too high a profit margin uh-huh. and their price was high and their sell-through was slow, and so they weren't really being successful with our diamonds, and in fact if they weren't successful, nor were we, because mm-hmm. we didn't have the opportunity to repeat the business.
Right.
And this went for quite a while until we said, listen, enough of this. We think that they don't know what they're doing. They're being greedy. We would like to take over that aspect of the business ourselves, sell directly to the public, lower the prices significantly, make the diamonds affordable. Mm-hmm. Repeating the words of one of the presidents who had said, chicken in every pot, we said we want to put a diamond on every finger.
Yes.
And they've got to become affordable. Mm-hmm. And so that was our purpose. And of course, having access to some of the world's finest diamonds, being able to get really good quality, getting them at the right price, and distributing them ourselves, mm-hmm. we said that's something we want to take over. And in effect, what in answer to your question about what surprised us mm-hmm. was how it was just wide open.
Yes, yeah, so there was almost an innovation in the marketplace.
There was nobody else doing it. Mm-hmm. The public loved it. of course, in order to sell anything, you have to tell people what you're doing.
Right.
Or you're not going to sell a thing anyhow. So we started advertising, both in print and then radio and then various other forms. Mm-hmm. We quickly learned that radio worked best for us, and we started spending more and more money on radio, telling people a very simple story. This is who we are. This is what our product is. This is where we get it. And if you come and see us, we work with you one-on-one, mm-hmm. and we can offer you a terrific deal and a beautiful diamond. And the public responded,
right.
And again, in answer to the question, it was so simple, why didn't anybody else think of that? Mm-hmm. But nobody did. We've got no complaints about that.
Right. So where did that come from? When did you first notice that you were able to come up with these ideas and say, nobody else is doing this, I should do it?
In the 1980s, early 1980s, around about, I think from about 85 onwards, and then we noticed many other things as well, that if you wanted to buy a diamond, typically you would have to go to a store in a mall, which was very inefficiently run, and you would deal with people who, talking about the salespeople, who most times didn't know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. They were either kids chewing bubble gum or people who were hired into the business because they were accept a low salary, but really not have any great talent. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, the people who were selling the diamonds had no clue about what they were doing, and they couldn't answer intelligent questions. And it was really the blind leading the blind. Mm-hmm. And so we came up with a number of ideas which would be totally different. One is we would sell by appointment only. Mm-hmm. We had the diamonds. If you wanted to buy them, we'd like to meet you, but you needed to call us and make an appointment and come and see us by appointment. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we were not going to be in any mall or strip mall or anything mm-hmm. like that. We had nice premises, offices, in office buildings, and we were off the beaten track. So if you wanted to see us, that was great, but you had to make the effort to come and see us. Mm-hmm. We weren't going to be there just because people were walking around a mall and looking for something to do before the movie.
Right.
Thirdly, the premises were locked. There were doors, double locked doors that you had to come through to get in. It wasn't just walk into a wide open store in a mall with a 20-foot wide door or something.
Is this the way business was done in your shop in South Africa?
No, nobody did that.
Yeah,
we did it all completely differently, and we decided just to work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. Did it completely differently from the way everybody else did it. Everybody else did it in malls, open, come in any time, nights, weekends. And we decided to make it completely different so that people would say, how can these guys be so different from everybody else and succeed?
Right.
Well, must be something going on. Well, and that something was the product.
Right. And there's a service aspect to it. And I'm curious, you know, as you were growing up, did you see innovations that were happening as a model in the family business, either that your dad or
not really. No innovations which would lead to the way that we wanted to sell diamonds. And then two other things that I would just like to touch on and answer that question, because I wasn't quite finished. Mm-hmm. We decided that we didn't really want to sell a diamond as a product. We wanted to give people a broad education, mm-hmm. tell the clients everything that there was to know, show them the diamonds, and let the client make the decision with no salesmanship, but have super qualified people talking about it. Mm-hmm. That was all new. Nobody did that before. The public responded beautifully, and they loved it.
Is there a next generation coming up?
Uh-huh. There is a next generation. That's my son.
Uh-huh.
Very proud of him. Smart guy. Learning fast. Mm-hmm. Gets the idea. Is bringing in concepts that are really not something that I'm comfortable with, all the social media things, mm-hmm. but he is totally familiar with them, and he tells me that that's where the next generation is going, uh-huh. and that's where the future will be, and I'm more than happy to step back and say, okay, so show us.
So who were some mentors that you had growing up? Obviously your dad had a big impact.
My father very much. Mm-hmm. He was really a smart man. Mm-hmm. He was a refugee from what was going to become war-torn Europe.
Uh-huh.
He left Lithuania and Eastern Europe as a young man before the war. He was an orphan. He never knew his parents. He never had any real education. Never had any advantage. Got in a boat, arrived in South Africa. Young guy, teenager, no money, no language, no education, no nothing. Mm-hmm. But a lot of drive and very intelligent. And he built a huge empire. He was a very smart man. He had good insights, spoke lots of languages, mm-hmm. and he was a real role model to me. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate to watch him and to learn from him.
So how many hours a day did your dad work?
Well, he used to say 25 hours a day, and if you wanted to know how he did that, he got up an hour early.
that's the secret we need.
Yeah, get up an hour early. In fact, if you want to work 28 hours a day, get up 3 hours early.
Was your dad aware of you and your brother's success here in the United States?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. He was. He joined us a few years ago here in the States. Uh-huh. He was in his late 80s. He's passed on now, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. He passed on at the age of 94 here in D.C.
If you were here today with us, what would he say about you?
My kids, they're the best.
Great. Thank you. And what's the website?
MervisDiamond.com.
Great.
Spelling M-E-R-V-I-S, diamond.com. And it's all there.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn & Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn & Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients. That's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohn & Burnett?
CohnAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A and D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Colin Callahan, with my co-host, Mark Cohn, and it's my pleasure now to introduce you to Farhan Hamid, who is the CEO of Inadev Corporation. Farhan, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what Inadev Corporation is?
Inadev is a technology solutions provider who specializes in mobile technology, mobile application development, as well as some other areas, and we sell to the federal government and also provide services to commercial customers.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been doing this business?
This business has been about 4.5 years for mm-hmm. us now.
Mm-hmm. And did you found it?
I'm one of the co-founders. I have two partners mm-hmm. Who are more of the technology guys, and I'm more of the business guy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good. We have very complementary skill sets, actually. Mm-hmm. People see our titles and they realize that that's the exact title that this person should have uh-huh. based on their personality.
So it's a good partnership.
It is, yeah.
So how young were you when you realized that you liked business and deals and that sort of thing?
I was probably in college when I realized that I liked business as well as politics and government. Mm-hmm. And I've spent most of my career in government in some way, shape, or form. And the reason I like doing the current business that I'm in with Inadev is that it brings together a lot of the skill sets that I have and a lot of the passions that I have with both business and government.
Mm-hmm. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have one brother older mm-hmm. than me.
Mm-hmm. And your mom and dad were doing what?
My mom and dad were both PhDs, immigrants to this country. They mm-hmm. came over in sort of the first wave of immigration in the 60s mm-hmm. From India, mm-hmm. and they landed at Oregon, University of Oregon, and they did their PhDs over there, and then moved to Chicago and worked at the State Mental Health Hospital for about 30 years.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like being a second generation?
It was interesting, and I think it gave me a very interesting perspective on being an American. Uh-huh. So I got both the immigrant viewpoint from my parents and my uncles and folks like that, as well as my own perspective of being born and raised in this country.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, Farhan, what's the special sauce that defines you? What makes you different from your peers?
I think I have the ability and desire to be able to run through a brick wall every day.
And where does that come from?
It comes from really just a desire to succeed, to prove to myself more than anything else that I'm good at what I do, and that comes from really trying to help people in the end, because I think the services that we provide actually do help people. But we, you know, there's a very competitive streak there, and it's a competitive town. So again, it fits well.
Mm-hmm. You said in the green room that and you did just now too about being in state and local government. But you were a little more than just the average state worker.
Yes.
Tell us about some of the things you did in Chicago.
Sure. I started in government as an attorney. I was assistant Illinois Attorney General mm-hmm. for a couple of years. So I was one of a bunch of attorneys who mm-hmm. Tried cases representing the state of Illinois in front of judges and going to court and arguing cases, which was pretty fun. But I went into private practice for a couple of years with a law firm, and then I went back into government. Mm-hmm. I worked for the city of Chicago as an attorney, and then as a more of an administrator and manager. Eventually, I was a managing deputy comptroller for the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. It meant that I had responsibility over a large portion of city finances, including the city's health care, which is about a $400 million budget.
So how do you get from managing a $400 million budget to running a mobile technology company?
Yeah, that's a good question. it's not an obvious leap, so let me try to explain. When I was in the city, one of the things that we were doing was we were doing public-private partnerships, mm-hmm. which is another name for that is infrastructure privatization. Mm-hmm. And I was involved in those deals. For example, we did a transaction to privatize the Chicago Sky Bridge, uh-huh. which is a toll road going from Chicago to Indiana. And we did a 99-year lease on that toll road for billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And those deals became rather popular around the country. So there was a lot of banks around the country that started raising funds to do those types of transactions. One of those banks was FBR Capital Markets in Arlington, Virginia. And Mayor Tony Williams was the former mayor of D.C., mm-hmm. was working there as a... he was the CEO of a subsidiary company that they were starting up, and they were raising a fund around doing these types of deals. Mm-hmm. So he recruited me to come out there and work for them.
So that's how you got to the Washington area.
Yeah, that's how I got to the Washington area. Mm-hmm. And with him, it was interesting because we went all over the country, meeting with different mayors, governors, and different government officials, mm-hmm. And trying to raise our fund. But the timing was not good. So after spending 13 years in government, I decided to go into investment banking and real estate in 2008.
Eight, I was going to say.
And that was not the best time.
Yeah,
to
what was
that.
The biggest surprise about that?
it was pretty shocking because we were sitting there in the bank, and all of a sudden there were entire floors that were empty.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a rough time, so it exit out of there.
Yeah. So how does that rough time help inform you as a leader today with your company?
Well, I think there's just a lot of lessons learned. you know, leverage is one thing that I've always been interested in, and sometimes people call it other people's money, and it's important. It's an important factor, which is finance, when it comes to any type of business. But there's a responsibility involved too, and there's always going to be a price to pay for borrowing money or raising outside funds. So we've been very careful. So far, we've been completely self-funded. We are raising some funds for an outside company that we've got a product that we're spinning out. But I think overall, it's just learning a lot of tough lessons along the way. Yeah. And believe me, we make mistakes every day in our business, but we just have to learn from them.
Well, Mark, did you have a question?
Yeah, what did you learn from your mother?
My mom was a pretty remarkable person. She was a social activist in addition to being a psychologist and a PhD. And she started a nonprofit about 15, 17 years ago. She's since passed on, but that organization continues to grow. And what it does is it provides services to battered women, children, has a domestic violence hotline. And she was one of the people who really forged ahead in terms of social and economic empowerment for really people who were underserved.
So there's a bit of a social conscience that you picked up from her.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And how about your dad?
My dad is still part of that organization. In fact, he's the CEO of that nonprofit. My brother works there as well. My dad, from him, I picked up a lot of really good people skills. Mm-hmm. So just the ability to work with all different kinds of people and form coalitions and sort of that more of that hard-edged political maneuvering that's involved with whatever kind of enterprise you're you're engaged in.
So I'm getting a sense on one hand, in your background, there's this financial, hard-nosed deal-making kind of guy, and then the social conscience. How does that blend in your business? What's most important in your business?
Well, I think for us, it's the culture of the company in terms of how we treat our employees. And having worked in large organizations like City Hall and big investment banks and things like that. I wanted to have a culture, and my partners also want to have a culture where we treat our employees really well. They have the freedom to express themselves in whatever way they want to support them in their jobs, and just have really good, smart people around us and let them do their jobs.
How does that make your company better? Because a lot of people might be running companies and not doing that. They just want to squeeze it out, but there's something special in what you're doing.
Well, I think it's important to have people who are more talented than you. And it's the team that really makes the success of the company. I happen to be the front face of the company, but there's a whole lot of people, starting with my partners, who are really the ones who make the company work and make it successful. And, we just kind of go with the flow.
Where did you learn that humility? Because that is, there's humility rings.
Well,
in that.
I mean, it's really the truth, to be honest with you. I mean, everybody has to contribute what they can to it, and everybody brings a different skill set to it. But I think the great thing about our company, about Inadev, is that people treat it as their own company, and we give people a stock in the company so that they do really feel like they have a stake in it and it is their company. And so we want them to take pride in it. And it's something that they do on their own. They take their own initiative to do that.
Was your mom aware of your success?
Yeah, she was proud of me. She was very proud of me. She passed away in 2005. So she didn't really see me come out to DC and get involved in the business world.
What do you think she'd say if she were here today?
I think she'd be very proud of me.
Great. What's the website?
www.inadev.com. That's INADEV.com.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this business spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. Welcome, Jody. Jody, what is Acumetrics?
Acumetrics is a firm that works with CEOs that are interested in growing their revenues and bottom lines in a scalable, sustainable way.
And what's your role within the company?
I'm the founder and president.
And what is it about the job that you bring that's so unique to you, that special gift, as we say?
That special gift? I enjoy working with the CEOs to have them achieve goals that they thought were impossible.
And what is it about the organization that makes it so special?
We work, our clients say that it's the three P's: our people, our platform, and our processes. Our people are highly qualified and they're fun to work with. Mm-hmm. Our processes are enabling of reliable and timely financial information, and our platform is scalable.
And who is, or what is perhaps, the perfect client for you?
Businesses of any size that want reliable, timely financial information.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I enjoy working with the clients and making a difference. We like to help the CEOs understand their financial information so they can make different choices tomorrow to impact future results of the business.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.acumetricsllc.com.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks, Les.
We've been speaking with Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Colin Callahan, with my co-host, Mark Cohen. And it's now my pleasure to introduce you to Cedric Nash, who is the president and CEO of Oakland Consulting. Welcome, Cedric. And what is Oakland Consulting?
Oakland Consulting is a services company that focuses on implementing enterprise resource planning systems for federal government, state and local government, as well as commercial entities. And we primarily implement products like SAP, Oracle, PeopleSoft, and Workday. Mm-hmm.
So these are the kinds of systems that allow companies to manage their customer interactions and sales and that sort of thing.
Correct. I mean, it's an integrated solution that enables the enterprise to basically run their business. Mm-hmm. You know, everything from accounting, finance, commercial or customer relationship management, mm-hmm. sales and distribution, inventory, manufacturing. It kind of integrates all those functions of a business under one software solution.
And when did you start this business?
I started the business in 1997. Mm-hmm.
So you've been at it for a while.
Yep, I've been at it for some time.
Now, how young were you when you realized that you wanted to do stuff on your own, wanted to break out and do stuff on your own?
You know, I believe that I was probably very young and probably... you know, as a kid, basically, I had the crazy idea to basically raise some chickens in my community and sell the eggs to members of my church. So that kind of started my entrepreneurial interest.
And you were like 8 or 10 years old?
I was probably about maybe like 10 to 12 years old. Uh-huh. And then I basically had paper routes. I had a couple of paper routes where I, sold papers to the local community and collected. And then I had several mentors in my community that were entrepreneurs that kind of always piqued my interest. So mm-hmm. I think from a very early age, I kind of got the entrepreneurial bug.
Right. Yeah. And where was home?
I'm originally from a little town called Seaside, California, which is outside of Monterey in the Monterey Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. And brothers and sisters?
I have one older brother, and I have a younger and an older sister as well. Mm-hmm. And then my parents adopted two siblings, so they're my sisters and brothers as well.
Great. And what were your mom and dad doing growing up?
You know, my dad was the local parole officer. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a job, you know, working primarily in the state prison, and then mm-hmm. kind of got promoted to be the local parole officer in the community. Mm-hmm. And my mom was more of a stay-at-home mom, but she also kind of helped the elderly in the Carmel Valley area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What did you learn from your dad in his job as a parole officer? What did you learn that shows up in your leadership style today?
My dad spent several years in the Army. He spent 29 years in the Army, mm-hmm. and he was a sergeant major in the Army. So he kind of brought that kind of discipline and that focus to the table. Mm-hmm. My mom basically, you know, was not really professionally trained, however, worked a lot in terms of raising money for the church, mm-hmm. but develop a really strong business development and relationship development skill set that I think that I inherited from her. So I guess together they've kind of given me basically both the sales and the discipline aspect that it takes to be successful in business.
Right.
I get a sense, too, and you can correct me if I'm off base here, there's a piece about your dad being tough but also compassionate as a parole officer.
No doubt about that. Mm-hmm. My father was the type that by the time he had to take parolees to jail, mm-hmm. you know, they were basically, greeting him at the door, ready to be handcuffed and to come in. Yeah, because he was very, very compassionate and very, very lenient, but he had, you know, he had his line, and if you crossed the line, then you had to do what you had to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did that affect you as a kid? How did that show up, crossing the line?
You know, my father was a very friendly and jovial person. However, you know, you knew that he meant business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all my sisters and brothers, basically, we never gotten in any trouble. We always basically did the right thing, and mm-hmm. we always had parents that we knew had, you know, high expectations for us in terms of integrity and how we conduct ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So fast forward a bit, did you have other mentors that helped you from a learning business and, you know, getting started in business?
There were two mentors in my community that really, really stood out. One was a gentleman who's a retired colonel in the Army mm-hmm. named Mr. Al Glover, African-American man who basically retired out of the Army and became very wealthy in the real estate mm-hmm. game. He also started a local community mm-hmm. bank and providing loans to soldiers, sold the bank, and became very, very wealthy, amassing significant amounts of real estate and those types of things. Mr. Glover's in his 80s now, and he's still in the community, and has kind of taken me under his wings, you know, right when I was coming out of high school.
Yeah.
Another one was a gentleman by the name of Gus Martin, who was a consultant who would fly into town to actually service radio stations for my dad's best friend, who was worked for a very wealthy man who owned radio stations and was big involved in oil. Mm-hmm. So it was Gus who basically kind of, you know, developed or nurtured my thirst for engineering and consulting. Mm-hmm. And from the ages of from the 11th grade, I kind of decided that I wanted to be a consultant and kind of held on to that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So what was your first job when you got out of school?
Out of college?
Out of college.
My first job out of college, I worked for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. But I still, because my background is software engineering, but I still maintain my entrepreneurial drive even through college. I sold computers to students mm-hmm. to kind of earn money, and then I also did a consulting job for a doctor.
So the chickens things was over with by then?
It was over with by then. No more chickens in college. Yeah.
It's a higher margin on a computer than
exactly.
It does eggs.
Yeah.
So did you, I think in the green room you said that you were working for some of the big six CPA firms.
That's correct. So I worked for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, got my MBA, and then got hired by Deloitte & Touche. Mm-hmm. And Deloitte & Touche introduced me to SAP, which is a software that I've been implementing over the past 20 years, and then later went to Ernst & Young after leaving Deloitte & Touche, and then restarted my entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah, you said you had worked with some partners in getting, when you started, first you had partners, and then you kind of broke away, and I'm trying to remember the question you had, Mark, about that, about going off on your own, just realizing you had more drive. That's what it was. You had
Correct.
More drive than they had.
Yeah, where did that come from?
Well, I think the story you're talking about is when I left Ernst & Young, I joined a group of Germans who were well-versed in SAP and mm-hmm. the older model before it kind of grew in the United States. And I came up with an idea of basically helping them market and grow their business in the United States, flew to Germany, convinced them to accept me as a partner, and then realized that they didn't have the energy or the drive that was really needed to be successful in an American business.
Right. They were ready for you to do the work.
So I've always had that sense of drive, you know, even as an early child, basically wanting to go faster, mm-hmm. wanting to kind of get there, so to speak. So, mm-hmm.
So you were born with that, you think?
Yeah, I believe that that there's just certain characteristics that you're born with, and you can't force young people or kids to have that, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, either they develop it later or they're born with it. But I think I was just born with a extra amount of drive and energy. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of what is in your leadership style today with your company that you got from your mom?
I believe that the salesmanship, the relationship part of the business. I mean, our business is consulting, and any services, and it's a services oriented business, and any service oriented business, the foundation of it is relationships,
right?
Because they can provide, or they can go to several of your competitors for the same exact thing. It's just a matter of who do they trust, and who do they want to do business with.
As a leader, how do you develop that in your people? How do you stimulate that?
I think that you lead by example. I mean, I treat my employees from a relationship, you know, standpoint, and they see that whenever we're in a tough moment or a tough situation, that, you know, sometimes you have to take one to the team for the team, because the relationship is more important than a petty issue.
Right.
And so, you know, so often, you know, we do that. We basically take the high road, and despite sometimes how uncomfortable and how frustrating that can be, but you know, relationships are everlasting, and so that's really our focus area.
Right, and that develops and shapes your culture.
Exactly.
Tell us about community involvement with your company.
Right, community involvement is very, very important to us. I mean, you know, my parents were very much involved in the community, and I think that growing up and seeing that, and seeing how, you know, my father's always lended a hand to somebody who's always been in need when we've had families come in and live with us who were, you know, who were struggling or having a hard time. So, you know, that was very, very powerful and profound for me. And it kind of taught me that basically that we have a responsibility as people, as Americans, basically, to kind of help your fellow man. So we've incorporated that within our company. So whatever little resources we have or we have left over, we share every year, and we have done that ever since I've been in business, either through scholarships, through, you know, through helping, you know, food banks or those types of programs. I mean, we basically have given.
Yeah. It's another example of leading by example.
Yeah, that's
setting
true.
Setting that for your employees.
Yeah, and also the employees see it, and it makes them feel good about working for the organization, that the organization is more about, is more than about earning money, earning about revenue. It's really about making a difference in the community.
Are your mom and dad aware of your success today?
They are. My mom died when I was 19, so she's passed on. But my father and I maintain a close relationship, and he's very aware of it, and he knows, and I think he's very proud of the fact that, you know, that I haven't lost touch with the fact that giving back is important.
Yeah, exactly. Right? What's the website address?
Our website is www.ocg-inc.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Cetric.
Thank you.
We've had a great lineup of guests today. First, we had Kevin Lancaster, who's the CEO of Windvale. Then we had Ronnie Mervis, who's the owner of Mervis Diamond Importers. Then we had Farhan Hamid, who is the CEO of Inadev Corporation. And then finally, we've been speaking with Cedric Nash, who's the president and CEO of Oakland Consulting. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohen of Opti4, for helping develop our storyline and hopefully to deliver to you, our listening audience, an entertaining and educational show. And also, I'd like to thank you, the listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a show at all. So thank you. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. And you can hear this show again at businesstalkradio.net. Please tune in again next week and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
The National Building Museum presents Designing for Disaster, a new exhibition exploring how design, engineering, and construction respond to natural disasters. Discover how we can save lives and build more resilient communities. Featuring the interactive Wall of Wind, where visitors of all ages can test proof performance in hurricane force winds. Open now at the National Building Museum. Find hours and admission information online at nbm.org. That's nbm.org.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This